In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the end of Roman Britain, a History Extra podcast special series. This is episode 2. Hello and welcome back to History Extra's End of Roman Britain podcast series. This is episode 2 and my name is David Musgrove. I'm your host for the series. In the first episode, I took you to Chedworth Roman Villa in a quiet corner of rural Western England for a look at a recently unearthed mosaic that seems to suggest that some people, at least, were trying to carry on a Roman way of life a few decades after the traditional end of Roman Britain. Now, that endpoint is going to be challenged as we go through our series, so hold that thought. But before we can properly interrogate what happened in and around the start of the 5th century, we need a thorough understanding of what things were like in late Roman Britain. And for that, I've enlisted the help of Nottingham University's Dr. Will Bowden, who's Professor of Roman Archaeology there and an expert on the topic. He's our guide. And the first thing I asked him was if he could define and characterise late Roman Britain for us. So here we go, over to Will.
So we're looking, I think, really at the later 3rd and 4th centuries in Britain when we talk about the late Roman period. And it's a period that is very much characterised by archaeologically visible things, like a lot of the coin finds that we get from Britain come from this period. It's by now a monetized economy, or at least there's a lot of coins floating about. Most of the great villas that we get in Britain come from this later period. Conversely, things like towns are really quite dramatically changed by this period. So the things that we associate with towns, like the forum, the public space, this sort of public spaces and this sort of thing, they're really quite dramatically changed by this time. The monumental Roman town seems to be quite, in many ways, quite a short-lived phenomenon. And by the 4th century, these sorts of towns are have very much dramatically changed, I think.
Tell me more about the towns. So what, they are in decline in this period?
They're in decline if you think about the town as being represented by a very specific view of the Roman town, which is the one with monumental buildings, people strolling in the forum, and this sort of thing. In some ways, I think this never really takes off in Britain in the same way as it does elsewhere in the Roman Empire. And so we've got quite a short moment, really, in the second century where towns start developing, street grids, public buildings, and this sort of thing, and start assuming a slightly sort of monumental form. But really, that is changing quite significantly by the later third and fourth century. So, for example, a number of the fora of Roman Britain, and the forum is the principal sort of government building, public government complex, public meeting space. They are being used often for rubbish dumping and for small scale industrial processes. By the fourth century. So it's like as if county hall in a county town at the moment has been changed and used for metalworking and this sort of thing.
Okay. So we'll come back to that in a second, because that's an interesting observation. I wonder what, in terms of sources and our ability to understand late Roman Britain, you've talked about the archaeological evidence there. Is it a period in which we have a reasonable level of sources, both archaeological and historical, to understand what's going on?
No, I think in many ways the archaeology is, I wouldn't say better, but it's certainly more specific to Britain. The problem with our textual sources, they're quite limited in number, and few of them are interested really in talking about Britain as a place. What most writers like about Britain is that it's a long way away from where they're writing, and it's over the sea, so that's difficult, and it's full of weird people. And one of the idea of Britain being a long way away and weird is a continuous trope that we see in Roman literature, really from the moment people start writing about Britain. So we have a number of sources in praise of emperors in the particularly in the fourth century, the so-called the Panegyrici Latini, and these are people writing paeans of praise of particular emperors and their achievements. And one of these achievements is quite often putting something right in Britain. And the achievement of the emperor is enhanced by the fact that Britain is a long way away, it's over a stormy sea, and is generally quite a problematic place. So that's one of the key things that interests Roman writers about Britain, is it forms an arena for achievement. Some of the sources also, they obviously focus on Britain when there is a problem to be dealt with. And so it's things like usurpations and rebellions, attacks by barbarians, that tend to figure quite heavily in the textual sources. And because that's the moment when Britain impinges on the consciousness of these Roman writers. But it's also worth remembering that we have a very limited number of sources that actually discuss Britain, and there are certain periods of time that see more attention than others. But this is the big problem with the late 4th and 5th century, in that the sources are very limited and tend towards a picture of catastrophe, which is often not quite borne out by the archaeological evidence.
Just going to take a pause there and play back a quote that Will said in that last answer. the sources are very limited and tend towards a picture of catastrophe which is often not quite borne out by the archaeological evidence. And that's a pretty interesting comment, which we'll come back to during the series. But I wanted to know if we do have any voices surviving that could be described as directly from late Roman Britain. So back to Will for an answer to that.
We have no one writing from the point of view of someone who is in Britain. Yeah, until we get to Gildas in the sixth century. So nothing is being written from a British point of view.
Okay, so we're hearing voices from afar talking about what they see about Britain, but not very many voices specifically talking about it. And we've got archaeological evidence, which is, I guess, somewhat patchy in some places. Give us the political framework for the period. What sort of things do these distant voices tell us was going on in Roman Britain, I guess, in the wider empire during this period?
Well, it's a period of often of political turmoil, and from the later third century, we have a system of government in which the empire is divided into two, and so we have an emperor in charge of the Eastern Empire and an emperor in charge of the Western Empire, and those emperors have they're the Augustus, and then they have a junior emperor called a Caesar, who is supposed to take over. The Caesar is supposed to take over from the Augustus after a period of time, and it's supposed to ensure an orderly transition of power. But what happens is that you start to get any number of different claimants to the imperial throne, and so we have numerous people claiming the imperial throne and quite often fighting each other. Britain plays quite a big role in this. It's described later by Jerome as a land fertile in tyrants. So Britain seems to be throwing up quite a lot of these usurpers. And that's probably because it has quite a large military garrison, and it's a garrison which is a long way from Rome. And obviously, these forces, they support their own leaders. And so we have a number of usurpers coming from Britain and being declared as emperor, and then often then going off into Gaul and either becoming successful for a time or being defeated by the incumbent emperor. So it's a period of political turmoil, certainly, or at least that it's political turmoil that gets emphasized in our sources.
Would you say that Roman Britain was still in some ways felt like a frontier province, you know, in this period? Obviously it had been part of the Roman Empire for several centuries by the time we get to this, but you mentioned it was heavily militarized still. Does it still have that sense of being the outer extremities of the empire, which physically it was, clearly?
It's very much integrated, I think, into the empire. And one of the things that Britain is really doing in this period is functioning as a key part of the supply chain of the Roman military. And so we've got, you know, pretty good evidence that both textual and archaeological, that Britain is supplying the Rhine frontier of the, you know, so supplying the garrison on the Rhine frontier with, you know, cereals, possibly meat and other products. And so Britain is absolutely crucial to the Western Empire in that sense. But the fact that it's always across the channel, I think that does put it on the, you know, mentally and of course physically on the edge of the Roman Empire. And we also, I think, have to remember that when we think of what we tend to think about as Roman Britain, really constitutes, you know, between a third and a half of, you know, of the British, of the British mainland. So there's quite large sections of Britain that are never really participating in the set to the same extent, you know, that the southern and central parts of Britain are.
That's a good point. Could you perhaps just characterise a bit more fully for us the different way of life across Britain generally? So you've got this the southern area where perhaps it's more Romanised, and the north where things are a little more militarised. Perhaps, I don't know, how would you describe the differences geographically in Britain?
Okay, so we've got a zone, which is the southern part and the central part of the country. So we've got the southeast, then we've got places like Wiltshire, Oxfordshire, and then a sort of eastern half of the country. And that produces most of the things that we sort of tend to associate with Roman Britain. So towns, villas, extensive use of initially imported pottery, and then other types of fineware material. Also probably the places that are participating most in, you know, in terms of new forms of changed forms of diet and consumption. So that's the things that, you know, turn up in all our textbooks as being Roman Britain. And when you study Roman Britain at school or whatever, that's the bit that produces the pictures that you see of things that are Roman. But we've also got other parts of the country which are doing really quite different things, but I think which are still equally important. If you look in the West Country, say in Cornwall, there are a lot of, you know, settlements there, places like Kaizoster or Trithurgi, which are small settlements where people are living in stone roundhouses, in a way of life which is very much removed from what we think of being Roman Britain. But they are still in receipt of imported materials, still using non-local pottery. So in some ways, I think it's a conceptual thing. Yeah, this is going on in the 4th century in Britain, yeah, just as much as people are living in villas like Chedworth. And it's just simply the way that we conceptualise these areas. Scotland also is very much part of this world, even though large swathes are outside Roman political control. There is still a lot of Roman material, particularly silver coinage, going into Scotland and playing probably a key role in how people in Scotland are they're using this types of material for their own purposes in constructing sort of political and social relations. So places like Scotland and Cornwall, which tend to be left out of the general appreciation, I suppose, of Roman Britain, are still very much, I think, a part of it, but just in slightly different ways.
And that's an interesting point you make about Scotland. Does the sort of the reach of the empire go across the Irish Sea as well to Ireland? Do we have any sense about what was going on there, and how similar or different it was to what was happening in Romanized Britain?
There's always been quite a lot of dispute about that, and the idea of a Roman presence in Ireland has often been quite politically charged. In Ireland, but there's certainly increasing evidence, I think, of material making it across the Irish Sea. And as we get into the 5th and as we get into the 5th and 6th century, a little later, we're certainly seeing a network in which Ireland and, you know, the west of Britain are very much, very much connected.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Let's just take a moment to pause here. Will's given us a good picture there of where Roman Britain was and where Roman Britain wasn't geographically. But I want to get a better understanding as well of how Romanisation impacted on Britain's social strata. As we go through this series, you're going to hear several of our experts talking about different reactions from the elite part of society versus the rest to changing circumstances through the 5th century. So I thought it'd be useful to check in with Will now to see if it is a reasonable assumption to imagine a society in late Roman Britain which was wildly unequal.
Yes, I think that's a reasonable assumption to make. One of the problems that we have, of course, is that there are only a relatively small number of people tend to be the most visible in both textual sources and in archaeological sources. So it's the richest people that leave the largest traces, and leave the traces that traditionally were the subject of interest for archaeologists. So for a long time, people liked digging, you know, villas and things with mosaic floors because they looked nice and they could be fitted into the scheme of things by which we understood the political history of Roman Britain. And also, you know, frankly, they were easier to find. A villa leaves a much larger archaeological trace than a settlement that is made of much less permanent materials. So there is a certain number of people who are doing extremely well out of it, and some of the wealth that turns up in Britain, in things like the hoard evidence, we're talking really enormous quantities of silver, silver particularly, but also gold. And so, yeah, certain people, wealth is really concentrated in the hands of a certain fairly small number of people.
Right. So we've got a period where things are changing, clearly. You've talked about towns feeling a bit different in terms of what's going on in them. What challenges are people in Roman Britain facing during the course of the later 3rd and 4th century, and how are they addressing them, do you think?
In terms of challenges, I think we have to be a little bit wary of seeing the picture extrapolated from the textual sources of, you know, continuous political unrest and the attacks from people from beyond the frontiers. I think it's quite likely that although the emperor may have changed on frequent occasions, it's quite likely that many people might not have actually noticed this. They might have noticed when a new head popped up on the coinage, but in terms of the actual effects on people's lives, I think that might have been. We have to be wary of overstating this. I think possibly the real challenge that people were facing is the need to supply a large military machine, both on the northern frontier of Britain and, as I say, also on the Rhine frontier in Gaul. And I think it's very clear from the archaeological evidence that quite a lot of what is happening and what is archaeologically visible in Britain is connected with that military supply network. And so I think it's clear that from the archaeology, certainly of this central and southern British area, that a lot of what is happening in Britain is really tied in to that supply network. And I think that is clearly going to be quite an economic burden on the province.
So people might well have been living fairly sort of stable lives, unimpacted by the political turmoil that textual sources speak of, but burdened by having to produce an economic surplus to support the military machine of the empire.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's in terms of the overall burden. I mean, one of the things that we see about Roman Britain is it is one of Britain's sort of first big consumer ages. There is a lot of stuff floating about in Roman Britain. It's a very it's archaeologically very, very visible. And so even on the smallest rural sites, people have access to quite fine quality, to good quality pottery. There are items of dress jewellery floating about. And so certainly I think people, it's a system that also introduces and sustains a certain way of a certain way of life across parts of the province. As I say, for the people who are enslaved or living at the bottom end of the social scale, they tend to be less visible. But there's certain parts of the cemetery evidence, for example, that increasingly suggests that parts of the country, particularly these more militarized areas, are subject to, there's some evidence of pretty harsh judicial processes going on in places like the Fenlands. There's evidence of decapitation, burials, and this sort of thing, which have been interpreted as representing judicial killings. And so there's a sense of harsh justice present also certainly in parts of the province.
So this question is one sort of born with historical hindsight and therefore probably ridiculous, but is there any sense that there is any movement towards disengagement from the empire during the 4th century? Is there any sort of preparation to disengage?
It's hard to say, and I think we need to be wary of drawing parallels between more recent changes and the Roman Empire. I think the Brexit debate does have some things to tell us, in that the speed, I think, at which the debate became focused around Europe was quite dramatic, in that I suppose, you know, 15 years ago or so, it's fair to say that Europe was just something that floated along in the background and was not part of, you know, the day-to-day discussion, you know, bar the odd, you know, sort of metric martyr defiantly selling, you know, pounds of potatoes on the marketplace. But very rapidly, it became a central issue. And while I don't think, you know, we can draw particularly useful parallels between, you know, the Brexit debate and the end of Roman Britain, I think the speed by which people's identities sort of coalesced around the issue of being in Europe or outside Europe, is perhaps quite instructive for us. And we can imagine that certain factions would have developed in Britain. And I think we probably, you know, we see this in bits of the army who elevate their legionary commanders to be new emperors. We can get a sense of, you know, factions developing, and certainly we get this well-known quote from Zosimus, who's a late Roman writer, who tells us that the pressure of barbarian invaders obliged the British to throw off Roman rule and live independently, no longer subject to Roman laws. So, and some people have argued that there was almost a kind of peasants' revolt, if you like, against the imposition of against the sort of the tax regime, and the sense that the advantages of being part of the Roman Empire were no longer obvious. Although there's very much debate around, you know, around the extent to which that was the case.
So Zosimus was writing in the early 5th century, wasn't he?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so where do you stand on this debate? Was there a dramatic dislocation? You've just made a very interesting point that things change very rapidly. Do you see something significant happening at the start of the 5th century?
Yes, I think I would see something fairly significant happening at the start of the 5th. I mean, what we have to be really careful of is that archaeologically the change is extremely visible. And we go from a period in which there is, you know, for example, a lot of very well-made hard-fired pottery, mass-produced, being circulated around Britain, and quite widespread use of coinage, which is also, you know, pretty prevalent in Britain throughout large swathes of Britain throughout the fourth century. Really, that all disappears in the first couple of decades, really, of the 5th century. And for archaeologists, that creates an enormous problem, because we move from a period in which we've got loads of really nicely datable stuff, things that happen in the 4th century, we can normally place archaeologically within a sort of couple of decades, you know, which is great archaeologically. And then we move straight into the 5th century, into a moment where all this stuff really disappears, or at least dramatically diminishes. And so I think probably for archaeologists, it creates a highly visible problem, and we may overstate the impact of it. One of the interesting things about the loss of coinage, coins really stop coming into Britain from about 402 in large numbers, although small numbers trickle in after that. And yeah, by and large, people seem to stop using coins. And I think that's quite interesting in that it's clear that they, for most of the Roman period, people got by without using coins. There's a big sort of explosion of coin usage in the third century. And so people use coins pretty for various things, pretty enthusiastically for, say, you know, a century and a half. And then they stop and they're clearly getting by without them. I think Britain probably dropping out of the economic system of the Roman Empire, and that is an economic system, as I say, predicated on military supply. I think that has a dramatic effect on the sorts of things that we as archaeologists find and tend to study. But whether that effect is actually overstated, I'm not sure. But certainly there are sort of really quite dramatic changes from the 5th century onwards, and not only in material culture, in pots and coins, but then slightly later on we also see, you know, changes in diet and changes in other sorts of behavior. So I think it's pretty dramatic. I think the idea of the sort of long 5th century in which, yeah, sort of Roman rule more or less continues, but in a way that's very hard for us to see. I think in some ways that's quite tricky. But we should also see a country that is probably quite fragmented, and in, say, you know, the West Country, in places like Wiltshire, things may well have carried on in a much more recognisably Roman form than was the case in, say, the east of Britain.
So that takes us back to the sort of the geographical divide again. Some places you would definitely have noticed a change by the sound of things, and in other places you might have carried on a life broadly similar to what you were engaging in before.
Yeah, and I think it's certainly in the west of Britain, we see people, even in the 5th century, I think adopting a new Roman life. So you've got places like, again, Cornwall, where you see the emergence of people using inscriptions and to a much greater level, and also in receipt of imported material from the Eastern Mediterranean. And this material, you know, is turning up in even a sort of quite rural sites. So yeah, I think a regionally varied response to what's, you know, to the changes of the 5th century is something that's really quite apparent.
I'm just trying to give our listeners an idea about what life might have been like for people who sort of someone who was born in the year 400 AD in Roman Britain. And obviously, as from what you said, there's going to be clearly differences depending on who they were and where they lived in Roman Britain. But what might the experience have been like for them? Would they would have noticed that something was going on, or maybe they wouldn't?
I think they would have had to have noticed that something was going on. If you're born in 400, certainly, you know, your parents are probably participating in, you know, aspects of what we see as Roman life in terms of, you know, using coins, in terms of having access to, you know, a range of material goods. And that range of material goods does seem to disappear. I think it's also the case that people's aspirations might have changed the way you would identify, perhaps not with being part of the Roman Empire, but other identities might have supplanted that. And I think we certainly get more fragmented regional power structures emerging. And so your allegiances may have been much more local than they would have been, say, in the 4th century. I think in the mid-4th century, most people would have in Britain would have accepted that they were part of that Roman political structure. Whereas I think, in the early decades of the 5th century, that would have been, much more ambivalent. And I think if you are born in 400, it would have been, I think, quite a challenging moment for people's, sense of identity, their allegiances. And of course, we've got religious change as well through this period, which adds another layer to it. So I think we're getting a whole range of different and new identities perhaps emerging. And I think that may well have been quite challenging for people.
But it sounds like identity is being readdressed and reassessed, but it sounds like you're not arguing for a period of apocalyptic collapse.
Apocalyptic collapse, not as a whole, but I think, there are probably incoming groups of people in the 5th century, and we know that immigration, causes issues, and it's certainly likely that, for many of the people living in the early 5th century, there may have been episodes that would have been, pretty bloody and unpleasant. I don't think we should overlook that. That said, the evidence of wholesale, burning, massacres and this sort of thing remains, conspicuously absent, I think, from Roman Britain. But I don't think we should underestimate the extent to which, these sorts of changes can produce some, pretty unpleasant outcomes.
You've been listening to Professor Will Bowden from the University of Nottingham talking about the context of late Roman Britain. And if you want to hear more from Will, he's written a really good feature for the website historyextra.com all about the fall of Roman Britain, so do take a look at that. Now, Will mentioned religious change in that conversation. I'll be talking to David Petz about that in a future episode. But next time round, I'll be talking to Rob Collins about the military side of late Roman Britain and perhaps exploring some of those unpleasant outcomes that Will just mentioned, which the change in nature of military power might have brought about. So do come back and listen into that.